Mike, you know he did that intentionally, don't you?
I'm sure.
Good afternoon.
Just to confuse me.
Welcome all. I'm Ellen Boland. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at Marine Resources. Let's go around and see who we have today. Mark, you want to start? And
yes.
Before we started, because someone's on the phone and we got this feedback from Mike Osterling last time, please speak into your microphone. Because if we have anybody on the call, they can't hear, and the recording is not great. So get right up and close to it. Snuggle it up.
Mark Luckenbach, VIMS.
Perfect. Thanks.
Russ Perkinson.
AJ Erskine, Bevan's Oyster Company, Coward Seafood.
That was fantastic. Thank you, AJ.
Mike Osterling, Shellfish Growers of Virginia.
Beth Ledford, Flesh and House Oysters.
Kim Husky, Cherrystone Aquafarms.
Andrew Button, MRC.
Ben Stagg, MRC.
Also from MRC in the room, we have Hank Badger, we have Tony Watkinson, we have Jennifer Farmer, and we have one person in the public. And we have, on the phone, we have...
Ann Gallivan and Stacey Walker, Brothers.
Thanks, Ann. All right, it has been about a month and a half since we last met. Hopefully for all of those who are involved in General Assembly, you made it through with minimal conversations about elephants and goats. So today we are going to do a couple of things. I'm going to provide a very quick rundown of what happened at the General Assembly that is relevant to the work we do here. We're going to go briefly through the guidelines. We did not get very much feedback. Rebecca Kubin is also here. She's joining us. We'll be at the table momentarily. We're going to go through that. We're going to talk about the next steps for what that process looks like. And then we're going to talk about the beneficial use and use plans and sort of what does that look like. Also, what is the will of the committee to continue with meetings and the meeting schedule moving forward. I find it helps to have these set pretty far out so everybody knows. All right. So General Assembly this year there's a couple of things that are relevant to what we do here. A big one was a piece of legislation that passed, which was a Modernizing Submerged Lands Act. That bill did a couple of things that are relevant to our work here. Well, the big thing that it did is it takes the fees that were established in code last year, which are the fees for renewals, transfers, permits, and it puts them into an oyster fund. That money will be used specifically to hire people to implement the legislation from last year.
Did the ground rents also go into that fee?
Ground rents also go into that fee. Thank you, Mike. So the people that we're going to hire with that is a person to help Ben shop out specifically, to go over things like use plans, provide additional expertise, be able to check ground and verify a lot of the documentation we're requiring in this. We will also have a policy person. One of the things that we have heard and one of the challenges that we have is that we are often in a bit of a reactive mode. And so by bringing a policy person on, hopefully we can work with the industry and with the public fishery and really figure out what do we need to drive to in the next 5 to 10 years? What are some of the big things? Like I think about the conversation we had last time we met, which is things like, what are new diseases that are coming up and how are some of the things, what can we do about that? What does climate change and coastal resiliency and sea level rise mean for the industry? And so when that position comes along, we will definitely be talking to people about what are some of the bodies of work for that. And the last one is a person to also help out on the water stuff, both replenishment as well as restoration. Not me. The nature of the fund is such that come July 1, when the legislation is enacted, the fund will be at zero because we have to get money coming into it. We are looking right now trying to figure out, based on renewals and rents, sort of what are going to be the financial markers we will have enough money in that fund to be able to hire people. So it's not like we're going to be able to hire 3 people on July 1. It'll be an ongoing, probably year to 18-month effort, just looking at that money in the fund. One of the key concerns when this legislation was moving through General Assembly, which we very much took to heart, is what happens when this money draws down over time, which it was designed to do. The point of the legislation was to address bad actors, and to draw that money down over time. I have said publicly, Steve has said publicly, that it is the nature of any agency that staff fluctuates. It is not our intent, nor would we, go to the General Assembly to raise those funds. The goal is for those funds to determine some of what is the need on the water and to reflect as such. So we said that in hearing, but I wanted to say it today on the record as well. Any questions on that? That's a lot of information. Great. All right, moving forward. Oh, one last plug. When we do hire these positions, we will be sending out the email far and wide, and if you guys have suggestions for good names and good people, that would be very helpful. So that'll be the fall before we can get there. All right, next item. We are going through the guideline document for lease renewals. This had minor changes in it, a lot of which was based on the feedback that we got. Most of it was clarifying the intent. So there was no, it was just sort of clarifying the language that was around. So starting on page, Ben, do you want to, oh, Ben's on the phone. That's okay. The sort of one of the big ones was, I think that Ben added, was number three on page three. The language around clams. Okay. So we added language around clams. Oh, it's up there, I think. To the left. There we go.
Not the grass.
Oh, the grass.
Not the, I know.
No. We didn't have one for AJ, so I was like, why was she there? She's looking for it. So the name tags clearly are the most important part. So sort of clarifying some of the language around clams, oysters and clams. That was in the draft you guys all received. Also on line 94 on page 3, we originally had the lease shall not be renewed until such mandatory reporting discrepancies have been resolved. We took that to May. Because the thing with mandatory reporting discrepancies is they can run the gamut from you're off by about 10 bushels to you're off by like 1,000 bushels, and we wanted to give staff the discretion to say it's clear that they were trying to get this done, and we think this can be resolved. If it is a large enough problem, it also gives staff the discretion to say no. Like you were off by orders of magnitude, there's something wrong, you need to fix it before we can renew. So we were trying to give staff a little more discretion there. Mike.
Question, if mandatory reporting is being used to verify their production, why do they even have to make an estimate? Other than it makes it easy for you for enforcement efforts, but our job is not to make it easy for you to do enforcement, it's to make it easy for industry.
I'm not sure I don't understand the question.
On the renewal form.
Yes.
You asked them to estimate what their production was.
Yes.
But if they are using their mandatory reporting, which you already have, why do they need to document, why do they need to guess what their production was if they've already reported?
Yeah, I'm gonna let Ben answer this one.
And then I have a second part to that.
Sure.
Is there a way to allow the industry person to easily access what they've previously reported? If they don't have the records,
right,
can they access them?
So I'll answer the first question, and then I may or may not be able to answer the second question directly. But so the issue here, and the reason we changed it to May, is it does give us a little more discretion. If your mandatory reporting clearly shows you've had enough harvest, we're going to renew your lease.
Right.
Problem, the opposite problem is when you put down 1 million clams harvested and your mandatory reporting is zero, then we have a problem. And I'm hesitant to renew your lease based on your estimate. I don't know where you came up with the million. I know you put it on the form, but and we've had some of those where there's been a lot of harvest, oysters or clams, and zero mandatory reporting. It's usually a reporting problem. It was reported on a different lease. That's usually the problem. But so in those instances, you know, I don't want to renew it, until we get that resolved, because it may be that they're putting down the wrong information on this particular lease, and there was no real harvest. The leaseholder can get their mandatory information directly from the agency, but we don't give it to anybody else. And Andrew might know, because he works in the fisheries division that handles this. I don't know what the requirement is of someone calling in saying they're the leaseholder and they want their mandatory reporting. I know we guard that pretty stringently, because it can be converted to income, and you can't call up and ask for mine,
right?
Unless I've given some kind of permission.
There's a form they fill out for.
Okay. So
there is a method. It's just not quick and easy.
I think with the transition to online reporting, it's a little easier to view your past harvest reports if you're reporting online. But if you're reporting by paper, and either way, there is a form that you can fill out to request your harvest information by lease if you're the leaseholder.
They request that form from you or from Ben or from?
From mandatory reporting. So
reporting.
Yeah, on our Need the Form page there, that has all the forms there. It's a request for harvest information.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Is there any way, and I don't know if this is a good idea or not, but again, I keep coming back to it. When we get our annual lease rent statement and the leases are broken down, is there any way that you can put the mandatory reporting for each lease on that statement? Because then we would know yearly if where we were at, instead of knowing in 10 years if we were delinquent or not, that there wouldn't be an issue in 10 years down the road. We would know every year where we stood. And then that way we could also give feedback if we didn't report or why we didn't report on a certain lease.
The quick answer to your question, I guess, is yes, we could do that. We'd have to sort of change, one, our form. Two, we kind of double capture your mandatory reporting, because you have to mandatory report to the mandatory reporting program monthly, and we get it yearly from your rent statement in my shop. So we'd have to, I guess, alter our database to capture it, because we're going to need it for the whole 10. In this instance, we're going to need it for the whole 10 years, starting with 9 years ago, as we go forward. So I'd have to put that in the database as we capture it. So it could be done by altering the database. It's more data entry for somebody in my shop. So that's the best I can tell you.
Quick clarification. I think, Andy, what you were getting at is when we send the statement that says you owe rent, we also put on that, and this is what you've mandatorily reported for the year.
Yeah,
so we'd be reporting out to you, not... So we're not collecting information from you. We're sending you information.
Right.
So okay.
Our records should match any way that you add it up. If you're mandatory reporting monthly, then, or however the mandatory reporting happens, then what I have for the year should match what you have for the year, whether I'm checking it on the computer or if I'm calling in. And then that way we know we're on the same page before it's 10 years down the line.
Again, I think it's possible, but you have to understand the leasing program. There's sometimes a designated person. It's not the leaseholder, or is. I'm a little hesitant to say whether we could legally do it if we're giving out your mandatory reporting to someone who maybe you've authorized to act on your behalf, but I'd have to get a legal opinion on that, I think. We guard that pretty strictly.
Well, I think the problem with doing that for a lease renewal is, in many cases, there are many more individual leaseholders than there are product owners, and those are the persons responsible for reporting harvest activity on a lease. So in many cases, the responsible person may be one person reporting for multiple LLCs or leaseholders, and it's not always reporting off multiple leases. So the leaseholder and the person responsible for reporting that harvest, the product owner, aren't always one and the same. So that would make that information, it would be hard to, for us to legally give that out for harvest information, because it's not necessarily tied to the lease there. So it's tied to a product owner is how harvest is tied. It's not necessarily always tied just to an individual lease.
So it's something we can definitely look into, but I think there's probably going to be some actual legal constraints on that. But we can look into it. We can talk to mandatory reporting. We'll talk to our attorney and get back with y'all to know if it's more, if it's a hard no or a maybe. All right.
Ellen, I just had a question. Are we going through the document by any section by section, or are we just general comments?
I'm just going through the key changes that we made to flag for you all, and otherwise this is a document you guys have seen a lot, and so I'm going to go through the key changes, and then we'll come back for a round of comments.
Yeah.
All right. So there was that one. There was on page 4, line 142, we got some pushback on shell turning, pretty significant, so have struck that. Namely, because of some of the other stuff we've done around in terms of requiring you to actually put shell down if you're dredging, a lot of the other production standards, and the catch-all is sort of, you can consider other factors. But there was some pushback on whether or not that was scientifically supported. And then the last change we made was on page 5, line 166, the commission can consider other factors not within these guidelines if deemed appropriate. We struck that because that's in the code. The code states that the commission consider other factors in 1205 and a variety of other things, but like the code language was stronger than guideline language, so we struck that. But it's still captured in the code.
You also made changes on 152 and 160,
thanks,
removing the arbitrarily changing the size of the lease.
Yes. Okay. Sorry, I'm off on. Yes. You're talking about from page 4 to page 5.
Correct.
Yes.
Well, I'm looking at the line.
Yes, that is into my page. That we had talked about being able to, for renewal purposes, reduce the size of the lease. The language that was added was in conjunction with the leaseholder. We would not just do that unilaterally. We would talk to the leaseholder. Thanks for the catch, Mike. Because that was in your comment.
That was one.
Okay, since you're on it. Appreciate it. And then that follows through also with the lease denial hearing on line 170 on page 5 or partial lease renewal. So it was not a significant amount of changes. So I'm going to open up the floor for any questions or comments. The intent of this, so in terms of next steps, is we'll go through comments. We can take a vote on this, or you guys can signal your yay or nay. We will take it to the commission, requesting a public hearing in March. We will request the public hearing at the March Commission meeting. We will hold the public hearing in April, and at that point, the Commission can decide whether or not to vote it up or down. As a reminder to everybody, we are required to do this by law. Code said we needed to do, the legislation that passed last year said we needed to do some sort of something around renewals, be it regs, be it guidelines. So we are fulfilled, like, so the option of not doing something is not an option. We gotta do something. Just wanna flag that. Comments, questions, Mike.
Have you gotten a formal response from SMAC other than John D. Maria?
No, we haven't brought it to a vote at SMAC there. So SMAC has had this document passed through. I don't think I've sent out this most recent document. At the last meeting, I let them know that they'd be requesting a public hearing at the next commission meeting and a public hearing in April. I believe. So they should be aware of that. Passes along to them as well.
AJ, then Russ.
So I guess I'll say this, and hopefully not be as boring and repetitive as I have in several other meetings, but I realize we have to do something and get something on paper. It goes back to the fee that I was not in favor of, but I know in code we had to do something. I just think this document is extensive and it tries to touch all these different areas, but obviously we're going to have missed some areas for renewals, and there's going to be that situation maybe adjudicated at the commission, maybe. But I go back to what I've said before, and we all undertook this back with the Secretary's work group to look at what we call bad actors. Now, I understand there's some semantics around the term, what have you. I think we all understand that we were looking at getting ground into the hands of people that wanted to make it productive and, according to the law, propagate shellfish. And I just think we're penalizing the good industry that is sitting at this table, that might be out in the audience, that might be listening to the recordings, and we're going through this for, I understand, we have to do something, but at the detriment of this industry. And I just want to put in perspective that there's a limited, it's well known, there's a limited shell resource in this state. Scientists would agree with that. Roger Mann has said that for decades. There is a shell shortage. There's seed. I'm talking about natural seed or spat on shell. And these areas that are leased, keep in mind, were second cut because Baylor got, and the public, got the best of the best. So this private ground has been leased for a number of years, and those shell resources that may have been more prevalent back then were put in these areas to build that ground up. And they have been, and they've been planted with seed, and aquaculture is going on in some of those leases, and a lot of good things. But I feel like we're going back into this and trying to take leases and lose revenue at the Commonwealth and here now at the Commission with the new legislation at the detriment of, I believe, the public interest, because that area becomes less productive. You're assuming that somebody is going to come in and take that ground up. And it really bothers me in some of these particular things, which I will make a specific comment on, I promise you. Like the buffer. You're going to reduce the buffer in the intent of what? Removing our area that we feel comfortable with as an industry that might say, well, it's 100 yards or it's 1,000 yards because it's a really important area where we have a lot of activity. And then that's going to be leased, so that buffer area is going to be shrinked and then leased. So I guess what I'm saying is I have issues with the document. I would have issues with any document. There's been a lot of good work that's gone into this. I understand that staff's done a lot, and I recognize that. But I just get concerned that we're penalizing the industry that's trying to do the right thing here and has for generations put their shell resources down, their seed down, and done that. And what is our goal? To take it away from some of those people or reduce their footprint so it's available to other people that want to do surface culture, which is contentious in and of itself, or we're going to take that bottom that is not productive and somehow the shell resources are available to build it up? I mean, nobody's going to go take, I would hope, nobody's going to go take seed and put it on bottom that hasn't been built up. Otherwise, you're throwing money away. So I do have an issue with the buffer language, and I have an issue with removing the shell turning.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'd like to comment on the buffer as well.
Okay.
In my concerns, I voiced two concerns about the buffers. One, the arbitrary nature, which you've addressed. But secondly, if you are reporting significant production from that lease that covers all the acres in that lease, then it shouldn't matter how much of the buffer is there. If a man has 20 acres, and he only uses 5 acres of it, but that 5 acres is sufficient to produce a significant production for the entire 20 acres, you shouldn't care how big his buffer is, because he has fulfilled his requirement to produce significant production over all the acres in the lease.
So very important point of clarification. If you have a lease that is 100 acres and you meet the production standard for the whole lease with 5 acres, you pass go. We don't go anywhere else. So where that comes from, the buffer part comes from page 4, where that's where other factors the commission can consider. So where buffers would really kick in is if you have a 100-acre lease, you've got 5 acres of productive, and they can't compensate for the full structure of the lease. So under the scenario you laid out, you're great. We look at it, you meet the threshold, and you pass go.
Okay.
This is if you get into other areas of, this is if the second case scenario, if you've got 5 acres, you have a 100-acre buffer, that's when the conversation would likely occur.
But the document already contains language for what you have to do if you do not meet the significant production. Then you have to explain why you did not meet the significant production, correct?
Yes, that's what the document, yes. So if you meet significant production, you go. This is for the people that come into the second bucket.
Okay.
And to AJ's point, this guideline document is a living document. So one of the things we will also be doing when this goes into effect, there will be a lag time, right? We will tell people this is coming. And then we will track over the year, 6 months, 9 months, 10 months, and report out to this committee sort of what does this look like? Are we actually, if the committee requests that, I imagine that they would, we can report out to you this is what it actually looks like. We're not going to have a ton of years of fact data because we can do the tabletop exercise, but it's hard to move that forward. But this is not something we're going to do and then never talk to you about it again. Bev, then Mike.
I want him to finish.
Okay.
I wanted to continue on what AJ started, and that is if you decide to reduce the size of the lease, whatever you've taken from that existing lease is now available to be leased, correct?
Yes, in theory, yes.
Well,
yes and.
Yeah, to me, that is actually encouraging the bad actors because now you have a piece of bottom that AJ didn't make productive.
Mm-hmm.
But AJ, on that piece, does have some productive ground. So now we have the opportunity for someone to come in and lease this little sliver in between AJ's productive ground and maybe someone else's productive ground, and that person is not leasing to grow, but to access someone else's product. So
you wouldn't know it for 10 years.
And you wouldn't know it for 10 years, exactly. So I have a little...
You'd know it pretty quick.
No, you wouldn't.
I mean,
Somebody would know it.
Yeah. You wouldn't be looking at it from
the
AMRC's.
Right.
So this came up, Ben and I had this conversation, and I'm going to sort of talk about it, and then Ben can talk about it, because I raised the same issue. And I think the thinking was that when this happened, the reason that you likely did not possibly use that area is that it wasn't productive ground, was going to be suitable. So that is something that we would tell the commission, we would tell the next person that applied for that, and that's something we would tell the commission when that person applied for that is, we said no earlier, so like, why would you do this now? So that's something that we talked about, and is understandable. Did you?
So, just to follow up, I would agree with what Ellen said. So, if we've consulted with you, which we now say we will, and we come to an agreement to shrink your lease, more than likely, it's going to be because we both agree that the ground is pretty useless, soupy mud or something. You are correct. We can't stop someone from applying because the code is still, that part of the code is still the same, but it does say we now consider 1205 and the benefits and impacts of shellfish aquaculture. So my thinking would be staff will tell the person first, I discourage you from applying for this. The commission took this ground out of production. If you want to proceed, staff will oppose it. We'll take it to the commission. The commission will make the final decision. We proactively have done that a few times in the past and gotten mixed results with the commission, as y'all all know. But we didn't have this law in the books at the time either, pointing us more in that direction. So just, I know that doesn't allay all your fears, but that's kind of how we look at this particular subject.
I understand what you're saying, but the concern is that someone still can lease it. And if they come before the commission and make a good case, the commission is going to go against your recommendation. And they have in the past, as you've noted. So that's just a concern.
Yeah, Beth, and then Robert. It's not related to this. I want this to finish being aired out.
Okay.
This isn't something completely.
Oh, okay. And I will. Okay, so Russ, did you have thoughts on the buffer? And then Ann, and then for the record, Jay Ford from Chesapeake Bay Foundation is here at the table as well.
I don't have any thoughts on the buffer.
Okay.
I have some thoughts on your overall document.
Okay.
Since it's about the fourth time we've looked at it, I think I've had the same comment three times.
Okay.
Last time I offered a compromise. So this time I'll try again with a different compromise. Page, line 149. I'd like it to say other shellfish production activity within the lease area instead of what it says on 149. So that's my first comment. My second one's a more global thought is, of course, this significant production, you know, or significant effort, I guess, been in the code a fairly long time, and of course, some things were added this past session and a half ago, or session before this one. Previously, didn't have any numeric criteria, and I'm not saying, I think the bushel an acre of effort is probably achievable on it over a 10-year period. I guess my only concern is you've got people that didn't know that was criteria, that maybe they're coming up, it's the 9th or 10th year of their lease. And true, maybe they could do a whole lot of activity if they know about this. Maybe they could do a whole lot of something to get the effort in place, or they think they did something, but they don't know how much, or of that nature. So I guess my concern is if you're going to numeric criteria, yet you're saying this pretty much is retroactive to up to 10 years ago. So I think that's probably a concern with some of the leaseholders that have been around a while and it feel like they don't have adequate warning of what has come upon them. And maybe some don't even know about it now. So, and the commission hadn't adopted this yet. So I guess that's my comment on that.
Can you repeat what you want 149 to say?
I'd like it to say, instead of what it says, floats or other permitted, I'd like it to just say other shellfish production activity within the lease area.
Yeah, and then I have.
So, Ellen may say I'm wrong, but I don't really have any problem with that language, except this is really about permitted activity. So, like floats or cages that don't meet the standard 12-inch or even the general permit 4. And if you want to change that language, I would just say you add other shellfish production activity that requires a permit. Because otherwise, if you don't require a permit, it's just something you're allowed to do on the lease already.
That'd be okay.
Enhance it a little bit more to clarify what it means.
That's reasonable.
Okay. That's fine. You're not wrong about that. Monday. So it's a legitimate concern in terms of how we apply this retroactively. And I think it is the intent of the staff, I don't speak for the commission, that this is not, and I'm looking at Ben, this is not going to be something that once the commission enacts it, we just bring the hammer down. That's not the intent of this. That's not how we work with the industry. That's not the intent of this. This will be an education campaign. There will be a push-out campaign. We will be talking to people. For the first set of leases that we renew after this guideline comes in, are we going to apply this hard and fast? Probably not. We're going to have to look at that and really figure out what this looks like. But we have to start somewhere, some point. But it is not the intent of this staff to pass this one day and just bring the absolute hammer down the next. That's not what we've ever been about. Ann, and then Mike on the buffer, and then AJ. Ann, Mike, AJ.
On buffer.
Yep.
It's on buffer. My comment is, again, I'm going to get on my soapbox for the seaside. It's a dynamic area. And so a lot of times we need a buffer because it changes so dramatically over there. So as long as there's communication with the leaseholder, I'm okay with it. But you know, things change a lot, and I'd hate to lose something only to have somebody else take it up. While we were watching it.
Okay. I wrote things down and probably forgot. I think it's AJ then Mike.
I'm buffer. So if we're still talking about that, I guess I completely agree with Ann. And I'm very concerned that, with all due respect, that VMRC is going to go and tell the industry that's been leasing this area potentially for a number of years that your buffer is wrong. Your lease area is wrong. And somehow you're going to constrict that area. And just, I don't know. I mean, I understand it's in consultation with, I understand we all, everybody up here works with VMRC all the time. It's a good relationship. But I'm concerned about the next bend. So somebody looks at it and says, well, I have the ability to reduce your buffer. I have the ability, not your buffer, I have the ability to reduce your ground. So instead of 100 acres, I think 25 is fine. I mean, this is not the goal, I don't think, of this. So I think buffer is best left to the leaseholder.
So looking at Ben again, my understanding is the intent of providing this language was to actually help out on leases that are very large, not meeting the standards, have it, you know, 80-acre buffer on a 10-acre lease to help you out and offer options rather than just saying, like, denied across the board. So I think it's our view that it's actually something that could be helpful. I don't think that the intent is to say we're not going to give you any buffer. It's just sort of figuring out what is right-sizing that look like.
But shouldn't that be left to the leaseholder that's been out there working the ground that's determined this is the buffer that I need? And if it's 80 acres on 10, I think it's fine. Productivity is what we're talking about, right? If it's 90 acres of mud bottom and there's been no productivity, fine. But if it's 10 acres of highly productive ground with 80 acres around, as the example you gave, fine.
But you already said that if those 10 acres satisfied the whole 90 acres worth of production, done deal. You don't have to worry about it.
Yes.
It's only if significant production is not reported for the whole lease that you'll look at buffers.
Yes, to state unequivocally here on the recording as well, if you meet the significant production standards, you pass go. You're good for the next 10 years. We're all good. The additional criteria are to find additional ways for ground to stay where it is and give staff more discretion in terms of denial. And that was what we were trying to do in terms of establishing that first line of a productivity standard, which I know gave some people heartburn, but providing enough leeway and discretion and ability for staff to work with industry that we're trying to find that sweet spot. That's cool. Mike, and then...
I'm not on buffers.
Okay. Does anybody have any additional... We could talk about other things. Mark.
All I wanted to say is that while I fully appreciate what Ann and AJ and Mike just said, my reading of what's in here coincides with just precisely what you just said, Ellen, is that it sets up, it basically just says to industry, just explain why you need it. I realize AJ said, quote, just leave it up to industry. What it does is it is up to VMRC about what's leased, but it does say, it doesn't have just that hard and fast rule. It says just explain it. And I agree Ben's not going to be around forever or not, but the pattern for the state and for VMRC for a good very many decades has been to listen to those explanations and be quite favorable. So I don't know what other language you could put in that could make it seem less threatening to industry, because I think there's a lot of latitude for ways you could explain that need, and I think if some staff in the future are not receptive to that explanation, we know the industry always has the backup of going to the commission. I would not want any of this to be something that really threatened the industry, that put them in a box. The seaside explanation in particular that Ann used about it being really dynamic is really true. I mean, it can happen sometimes overnight. But as I read this, you just explain it. And either the staff gets it and listens to you and pays attention, or you don't believe the staff did and you take it to the commission.
Maybe one last comment on both. So Helen's right. If you have production, you don't need to worry. So the key here is starting on line 33. And this is the old code section, but you can read along with me and you'll see where it changes. The new code section's in italics. But what the code said and then what it now says is, in determining whether there's good cause for failure to produce, okay, so now you're in the failure to produce. You're out of that category where you automatically get renewed. The commission, new language, in addition to other factors, shall decide whether renewal is in the public interest. And my feeling under me and future Ben's, I hope, would be, is it in the public interest to reduce the size of this lease, potentially to turn it over to someone who's going to use it as a bad actor? And I would say, no, that's not the public interest. So again, we'll have a discussion between BMRC and the leaseholder, but we have to factor the public interest. That wasn't in the code before. I would argue this is actually a benefit to you to keep your ground intact. Just convince us it's in the public interest to have a buffer. It's dynamic. I need to keep this entire. We'll have a discussion, and again, I can't guarantee you'll always like the result, but I think with this and the public benefits and impacts of shellfish aquaculture, got to consider that too. That wasn't in the code before either. And that's a plus and a minus. There's benefits and the impacts. But again, I think this is, again, if you don't meet the production. So, and it still may not be of complete solace to you that you always get the result you want. But that's the way I kind of read this. I think that's exactly what it says. So.
All right. Beth, I can't remember if it was at one of these early meetings or at the SBAC meeting where there was a comment made, discussion around when people have, and I would be one, and I'm sure everybody almost is in the industry here at the table would be the same, multiple leases where certain things are done in the summer months where you need a shorter time to get your product to the market, thank you. I was looking for a good word.
Cooler.
Oh, no, well, to the ice, to the refrigerated truck, something. Safe.
Yes.
Particularly when you're icing on the boat and that kind of thing. So that there was some discussion, if I recall it, about looking at not just the lease that's up for renewal, but at that particular Waterman's overall industry effort regarding other leases that were part of a game plan, if you will, on how they operated. I don't know if that's in here somewhere, and I just don't see it where it says other mitigating things, where it says, you know, this lease is only used July, August, and September.
Yep.
You know, that kind of thing. I don't know. Maybe I meant, help me.
Yeah.
Line 138 through 154.
Yeah, 150. So I would be more specific. Page 4, line 158. An operational plan which may include use of multiple leases for seed propagation, nursery, multiple lease rotation, best management practices, buffers or aquaculture enclosures, husbandry activities, and that's where the buffer language comes in. That's what we've been debating. But right above that is where we talk about operational plans. And as you got 138. 158. 158 is where it really starts. Sorry. And we will be talking, the next thing we'll be talking about is sort of lease criteria and use plans and sort of how we want to do that and things. And I think that's where we can really use your all's input to figure out what does that look like to make everybody's life easier in terms of documentation. But that absolutely is intended to be captured here online and starts 158.
My other two things real quickly, it can be quicker resolved like that. And one is I have some confusion on page 3 where it says, number 3, line 87, such mandatory reporting for the minimal harvest of at least one bushel of oysters per acre per year, provided the requirements in number 2 are met. For seed and shell planting, well, I have a small lease, 2 acres, where we do most of our nursery work and most of our actual harvesting in caged aquaculture, and we don't do shelling there because we're walking around. We don't put shell on the bottom. I don't understand how I can meet that criteria.
So I believe where we, so this is saying mandatory reported minimum harvest of at least one bushel of oysters for blah, blah, blah. Provided that the requirement in number 2 above for seed or shell planting are met when the harvest is by dredge or scrape. So it's specifically, if you are claiming that harvest is by dredge or scrape, then you need to put down shell. I can see where some of the confusion's coming in, though, and I think what we'll likely do is hit a period and then provide clarifying language that says, if the harvest is reported by dredge or scrape, you must meet the requirements in number 2.
Okay.
And I think that will clarify.
Okay. And the last one that I wanted to just mention again is this 9 years of history in terms of some of my fellow watermen probably are not good documentation folks, and so that if we provided a notarized statement that we did such and such, you know, in 2014 and 15 or something like that, would that be, you know, what is the documentation criteria is my question there in terms of photographs, notarized statements, other than harvest reporting, if you have any of these other factors that are listed on page 4, additional factors, you know, things that we do, restoration, like we did a restoration project with the Department of Agriculture, and Dr. Weston worked with us on it, and I think you knew about it, Andy. We put down, you know, we planted shell and all that on one of the leases. And we have all the forms that went along with that to document that. That's been 3 years ago or 4 years, I don't remember. And I can dig those out. But I guess the question is, at first, the documentation may be sporadic and maybe a little sparse is what I'm questioning there in terms of the history. Now, once we do the education and we roll this forward, we start telling people when you do educational things, when you do restoration things, when you do environmental things, make sure write a little page note and put it in your file for that lease. You know, and then you'll have it in your file. I can see that going forward. I just think we've talked at this group, yes or no, about getting that stuff together retrospectively might be a little tough. Comment on that? I mean, are you going to take a notarized statement that we took all the people from the Friends School out there and planted oysters?
Well, I'm not really certain I need a notarized statement. I'm accepting that kind of documentation right now because I'm having this problem already. People saying, well, you know, let me do some research, and they're compiling what they can.
Right.
Sometimes they have to go try to find a waterman. Maybe he's dead. You know, it's all kinds of problems.
Right.
So you're sending in the REAP form and you're having your signature notarized there, and we assume that means also that the information you're putting on it is accurate. So I would, as I said, I think previously, the more information you can provide, the better. But unless the other panel here thinks otherwise, I'm not really sure that having something notarized per se will give it that much more weight with us.
My question is, what are you going to consider? You're going to take the harvester's word for it.
Well, I mean, to some degree, yeah.
Okay.
And it's the same with, you know, saying you put shell on the ground. You know, if we spot check it and there's no shell on the ground, you know, that's problematic. But that's the best we've had in the past. This is still, I mean, there's only so much we can do here to make proof of what you've said.
An example for me would be, and I didn't know how this happened, and I haven't really been able to get answers for it, but, you know, we put a lot of shell. We take our small business, we get all of the shell back from our restaurants. Every oyster that we sell, we get the shell back, okay? And we cure it at an undetermined location. My church would be very unhappy to know about that. No, I'm just kidding. We put it back, okay, when it's clean, okay? And then we were out there working on the Lynn Haven, and we saw that there were these big barges and trucks, and they were putting cement on top of the shell that we had put in this one area to try to save the grasses or whatever, and they were pumping it over on top of the shell. So, you know, things like that happen. I know it sounds crazy, but it really did. It really happened, you know, so that your shell that you put out there 4 years ago is now covered with something else. You know, so we would have to just say, this is what happened, Ben.
You might want to call us when you see that.
Yeah.
See if it had a permit.
Mike? Follow up with what Beth just said and what Russ said. And I know you're already using a lot of these criteria to make your decision. But I suggested previously, and I'm going to suggest again, a delayed implementation after it's passed, to allow the watermen that Bev is referring to start collecting the information they need. So if the commission in April decides to pass this, give them 6 months, 8 months, whatever, before it goes into implementation, so that the watermen will know, this is your criteria, guys. Start gathering your stuff right now.
I don't have AJ.
Can I ask, since you brought up you were working off of line 158 when Bev had a question.
Yes.
And it's part of that bullet point, but it goes on at the top of page 5. And if I'm reading it correctly, it talks about, again, the buffer required, lease area buffer, deemed too large, and then it says, or for areas unsuitable for shellfish propagation. So is that to say that VMRC would be able to determine the area that is unsuitable for shellfish propagation? I understand it's in consultation with the leaseholder, but it doesn't say that for the areas unsuitable for shellfish propagation. It says it for the buffer.
So I'm going to clarify your question and then turn it over to Ben. So you're clarifying when we consult with the leaseholder.
Well, I'm asking in that bullet in particular, because I understand buffers four bullets up from that, but this one has to do with the operational plan aligned with 158 you were going through. And the VMRC may, in consultation with leaseholder, determine areas, if I'm reading it correctly, determine areas that are unsuitable for shellfish propagation. So, I mean, I'm coming to a point where you got a leaseholder that says, no, this is, you know, suitable for propagation, and you have the staff that's saying, no, it's not. Is that what I'm reading? And there's going to be consultation between the two, and we might not be happy with the result. Is that what we're saying?
Yes, I think that's what we're saying. We wouldn't just say it's unsuitable.
I understand this is in the bucket of, you know, it hasn't met the production criteria, right? That's over there.
So, we would consult with you first. We'd say, you know, we went out and checked this area, and we've checked it. In our opinion, it's not suitable. We either checked it, probed it, we dropped a dredge on it in some spots, we get no shell, it's just mud. But we'll come back to you and we'd have a discussion. And you might say, well, but I still need a buffer, you know, because I got a really productive area here. I would hate for you to put this back in circulation on the rare chance that somebody might actually get the lease, commission approves it. But yes, I think these both work together. You may claim a buffer, and if you claim the buffer, then we're going to have a discussion. Or the area we may think is not suitable. We may have been working out there, you know, adjacent to it, and the whole area out there seems to be soupy mud to us. So we'll have a discussion. Doesn't still mean we might not give you the whole lease. We're just going to have a discussion about, you know, because I think you're going to turn around and say, well, I need some of it for buffer. If you argue, I need all of it because I'm going to make it productive, then we're going to have a serious talk because we're going to say, well, how are you going to make it productive when it's not really feasible? We don't think it's feasible.
Right. I understand. And I guess this might tie back into Mark's comment before about, you know, there's a lot of this in the document that is good, and VMRC has worked with the industry for a number of years, which I agree. But I think we're on new ground here with renewals. We're talking about a lease that's been in production for 10 years that's coming up for renewal, not a lease application that's gone before the commission where there is a lot of you take proponents of it and opponents to the lease, and you know it might be trimmed down by so many acres based on staff recommendation. I mean, there are a number of things that go into a lease application, but this, for a renewal, this is kind of uncharted territory, you know, that we're looking at. Well, you know, the buffer might have to be reduced, and then if it's not suitable for aquaculture, which is not defined, we could reduce it again. You know, I mean, so I think there's a difference between the application process and the renewal process. So that's what makes me nervous. So on top of, I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot, but also when you say we're going to have a conversation, we're going to come back to this, it's an awful lot of work. I mean, for a lot of leases that are out in the Commonwealth, mm-hmm. it's going to be an awful lot of time. So.
And I was just going to say, over 10 years, our bottom changes.
Mm-hmm.
Significantly. In other words, it might be muddy 2 or 3 years ago, but with the environmental impacts and storms and things bring us, not anymore.
Okay. I think I saw, Jay, did you have your hand up? You're stretching. Mike.
Since AJ brought up line 58, one of the questions that I actually received from my members when I sent this out was, what level of detail are you going to be asking for in this operational plan? Is that something that we're going to be talking about in the future in terms of a use plan instead of an operational plan? The person was curious, what level of detail are you seeking from an operational plan? Is it what Bev said, we use it only in June, July, and August to relay our animals closer to shore? Or does it, you know, I'm going to plant X number of seed over an X number of acres or whatever? Has the level of detail been determined yet? And I'm guessing the answer is no.
Rock, paper, scissors. Has the level of detail been determined yet? You're correct. The answer is no. This comes from, and this language comes from you all, as we're having conversations about what you would put in an operational plan and the information that you all already had. I think Tommy Leggett actually influenced this substantially. So this is a direct reflection of what we heard from this committee. I think it will get further fleshed out as we look at beneficial use and applications and all of that get accepted. So I think it's like Ben said, the more information you have, the better it is. Thoughts, comments, concerns? Mike and then Ann. Mark and then Ann.
Just a comment. I agree information is something you want. My guess is that Ben would rather not read an essay about what it is you propose to do, that this lease is used to hold seed, this lease is used for wet storage, this is a seasonal place we move tails to. I bet he would like bulleted information more than an essay. It's my guess.
Just wrote, provide an essay.
Right.
And? But for...
with this bullet multiple leases, and I apologize if somebody has already said this, and I think Mike or AJ has brought up the multiple leases. I think it could be simplified that if you have multiple leases and you meet the production standard on one or all of those, anywhere on those multiple leases, then the what's up for renewal should have automatic renewal. That way it would simplify a lot of this. Then a lot of this would just go along a heck of a lot easier. And then my other comment, that's one comment. I don't know if there's going to be more comments, but on number 65, the extreme adverse and event, I would look to Vim. I know I've made this comment before, but I think that's worst case scenario. I think there's a lot that happens to shellfish growers on a smaller scale that I think it really impacts us, and I don't think it's captured in there. We've talked about diseases that aren't MSX or Dormo. We've talked about mortality events, just loss of animals, that somehow I think it needs to be captured in that statement.
What line are you talking about?
Number 165.
Oh, 165. I was looking at 65. Okay, thanks. Again, these are intended to be sort of catch-all buckets.
My issue is that, again, you have a willing industry sitting up here. There's a lot of growers that don't find you approachable. So no offense. I think that if you're going to use these as guidelines, I think if they understood, hey, it's okay, you had a triploid mortality event, they might not even understand that they had a triploid mortality event. All they know is that they lost animals at this time every spring at this time period, or they have tubeworms or whatever. They're losing animals and they're not making it. I think they need to understand that they're having farmers get subsidies. We do not get subsidies. This is all private money. And so people aren't very proud if they're losing their product. And they're not going to say that out loud, let alone to VMRC or VIMS. So I think we have to have a way for them to understand it's okay. If you're having issues, whether you're dealing with something that you don't understand or it's impacting your business, then they need to know that they're not going to lose their ground. They're not going to lose their livelihood.
Could you add unexplained mortalities on 165?
I'm trying to think of what's the right.
We talked.
First of all, there will be other diseases. This unexplained, this triploid mortality is something we're working on, and we don't quite get it yet. There can be runoff events that are localized that kill animals. So, broader language is needed in that bullet. I'm just still trying to think of what it is. It could even be as vague as, extreme, adverse, catastrophic, or other environmental events causing significant mortality. Something like that. That it is right now, things might not appear like extreme or catastrophic in some cases, or it might be too easy to shrug it off and say, this wasn't a super wet year. It wasn't.
They don't meet their standard, and then
within that one particular creek might have had some event. So for now, at least as a placeholder, maybe that list could include
unexplained mortality.
Other environmental conditions causing unexplained.
So what I have that you said is extreme, adverse, and or catastrophic events or other environmental events causing significant mortality.
I don't know if that captures it all, but like that is needed because, again, we'll see new diseases. We do see localized events. We do have some mortalities going on. The triploid mortality has got an environmental component. We don't know to what extent it's got a genetic rootstock component.
for now at least, that adds some breadth to it. And if I can think of something that's a little broader, I think that's very much needed. Again, that's because this is all about where it's giving you additional factors to consider, and it's not, as Ben, you pointed out, because of the code. It's not an exhaustive list. The code lets you consider anything else you want to consider, other relevant factors. But it'd be nice to get something in there that's
wrong. I feel like I'm a little bit prickly, but when watermen are coming up to me and they're telling me that they're having growers issues, I'm not, again, they're admitting something pretty big when they're telling me. And they don't even know to go to VIMS and say that they, hey, can you help out or can you check? I'm like, well, have you called VIMS? And they're like, So they're not even, to have it on their rate, and I would hate for them to lose their ground just because they don't want to go talk to VIMS or they don't want to tell you because they don't know.
So I think one of the things that will need to be done after this, and I am intrigued by Mike's suggestion of some sort of delayed implementation, just because we're going to have to get out and talk to people about requirements and reporting requirements and all of that, of, and I love feedback on this, perhaps not today, is sort of who to talk to, how to talk to them. I know that people don't necessarily find us approachable or VIMS approachable, particularly if they're having trouble in their business. That is not an easy thing to admit. But we are from the government. We're here to help. Like, I realize that's usually not the most helpful phrase, but right? Our goal is to help. The whole point of this was, again, I think circling back to the original intent when we all got together, is this stems, it came from a good place where everybody came to the table and said, we're trying to find a way forward, a path forward to help sort of everybody figure out how we can help the industry grow and thrive, and that everybody, and like the highest and best use of ground for everybody. And that was the intent from the get-go 2 years ago now, and sort of the intent, I think, of the agency moving forward. So I think one of the things we will need to do is, I think, figure out an implementation date and be clear on that when we go to public hearing, and also clarify, hash out a communications and an outreach plan on this. We can do that. Mark?
What I wrote down, I still think it's still a placeholder, but I broadened it a little bit because I don't think it's always mortality. Sometimes you can't sell your product because you've got so much other things in it. So at least for now, extreme adverse, extreme adverse catastrophic events and or other environmental conditions resulting in product loss. Because you lose product if it's not marketable. It's not just if it's mortality.
How about HAD? How about if we get stopped from harvesting?
That's right. That's product.
We're not losing anything, but we can't harvest it.
It's product loss. It's not product.
Losing product. We just can't harvest it.
Norovirus came up recently. My recommendation, after sitting through watching many General Assembly hearings where they were trying to legislate and regulate on the fly, is that we will work with Mark on this particular section, hash out some language, and email it out as soon as we get it. And I think that'll be a little bit easier to sort of tackle it, because I'm hesitant to agree to language now because we're throwing so much stuff
around. We don't want to keep it broad. Of course, Habs are so persistent in that location that over 10 years it's hard to make that. And that's probably a separate business decision. But yes, I mean, that's the type of things. Full algae blooms. There are years like 2018 and at least for some areas 2019, in which previously good growing areas of fresh water are not going to decrease. That's going to increase. We're gonna see that, there were oysters dying in the York River at the level of downstream of the York River State Park, because there was no salt in the water for a while. It was below 5 parts per thousand for a long time, and so we need to get. I mean, we needed to capture things like that too. So we'll work. I'll I'll keep thinking about it and get you some language we can pass by the others.
Okay, and we'll do that. We'll do a quick turnaround time on that. AJ.
So I just wanted to touch on the other point that Ann made, which was something we had talked about at this committee unsuccessfully several times, and that was the overall plan that if one or more leases of a multiple leaseholder is productive, then all would be considered productive. So I understand that's not going to go anywhere. But I do have maybe an alternative for this document under the consideration of other factors. And I don't know exactly where it fits, but again, this goes into the bucket where it doesn't meet the production. So this is a lease that, you know, is looking at this document. And I would say consideration of leaseholders, additional leases, adjacent or otherwise, that show significant production. So that would be under the bullet that allows for the commission or staff to look at the scope of other leases that are in that leaseholder's name. Consideration of leaseholders, additional leases, adjacent or otherwise, that show significant production.
Where would that go?
Okay, so
it's kind of like a new bullet under
those
additional factors.
Again, I think that sending us that writing, right?
So it'd be under the section of additional factors
that
maybe can be considered by the commission.
I mean, this
consideration.
And it's
166.
Yeah. I think isn't there code language that talks about proximity to other leases?
Yeah, but this is a little more broad.
Okay, so I just want to clarify what's an existing code. Immediately adjacent. Okay. All right.
Right.
You can send us that. That would be great.
Yeah.
Okay.
But AJ is implying that it does not need to be an adjacent lease.
Right. And you feel like that's not captured in the...
No.
In the operational plan?
No,
it
doesn't
exist. Okay. We can look into that.
Okay. Thank you.
Becky?
I think in our river, in the Lindhaven River, we would have, and I think in a lot of different areas, we would have a problem with that. If you have a lot of production someplace completely remote and there's nothing, no operational plan to show why you have 25 acres in the middle of the Lindhaven interrupting navigation or other beneficial uses, I think the public deserves to have an explanation as to why that lease is somehow tied to some other remote lease, no matter how productive it is. Because if that's the case, then you automatically get an automatic pass without limit on a number of other remote and, you know, leases of any size. And that's the kind of thing that this is designed to prevent. If we had a way that we could, you know, still use that and get the benefit that, you know, for our permitting purposes through these leases that are remote and not obviously used and not tied in any operational plan, then that would be different, but we don't have that.
I think that's a concern. Russ?
I would agree with that statement.
Okay.
So,
the
reason I bring it up is, again, it's not certainly set in stone, right? I mean, these are just suggestions to the commission and staff. So, I mean, that would have to be taken under consideration if there was a leaseholder that was abusing something like this, saying 25 acres in a completely different tributary is, you know, okay. I don't think that's the intent of this. Again, I'll go back to, there are good actors in this industry, so don't penalize them for putting together a document like this that they might have multiple leases that they've worked over generations to build a business plan. So if you want to spell out an operational plan, then that's what we'll do. But you're looking at penalizing the good industry for what you have seen as some of the bad industry in the Lynn Haven.
Can I respond?
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting any type of penalty. I'm saying The way that I understand it is if for each lease, if you're meeting the requirements, then you don't even have to look at any of these bullets.
Correct.
If you haven't for any of the leases, you have to show the MRC that they are somehow being used toward that end. So you're not just holding them for, a speculative reason, hoping that in, the right weather conditions, all of a sudden the Lynn Haven stops having 4 feet of silt and becomes productive overnight. You know, you have to show that there's some type of rational basis between those connections. And it's a relatively easy to meet test because it's, telling it to people who want to find a way to let you keep your lease. But to just automatically say you get that benefit because you're producing elsewhere, I think is too much of a benefit.
Okay. Any thoughts or concerns with the document? Comments? So are there any thoughts or concerns or comments on the document from the public? Yes. I think we're up to your microphones. I don't know if that one. Okay. You can come up and can you state your name? Thank you.
My name is Robert Johnson. I have been in the oyster business in the James and Nansman River for about 40 years, just a little bit longer than Ben's been with the MRC. So I have several concerns. Some of them have been addressed. AJ, I appreciate your points, and Mike and Ms. Arsenio, I understand where you're coming from. One question that I do have before I get to my points is that I don't understand if you meet the criteria for an individual lease, then the remaining area that's not productive, you get to keep. Then why can't you? Can't do the math in my head real quick. But if you have multiple leases and you meet the total production requirement for all of those leases, why that doesn't, it would sure make it a lot simpler on our end, not trying to duck anything or get out of anything. It would just make it much simpler on the working side of it to show that we are doing what you're asking to, what is being asked of us to do. The one point that I would really like to make, and it's a question and a request to this committee, is that perhaps you could make a motion, make a request to have Commissioner Bowman get an official Attorney General's opinion on whether or not you can change the terms of a lease in the middle of the lease. If you look at 603, and I am not an attorney, I'm not pretending to be, I'm sure if you hear me talk, you'll know I'm not, but 603 starts out the leasing process, and it's in the case notes below it, it says that it is alienable, which means it can be transferred or sold, and it is descendable, which means you can leave it to a heir. The way this is set up, if I drop dead tomorrow and want to transfer this to my two sons, there may be some pieces that haven't met whatever criteria there is, and I know it's happened several times already, that transfers were not allowed, even though the lease was valid and active, had 1, 2, 3, I don't know how many years left on it, that lease was valid and the transfer was denied, which to me is the Commonwealth of Virginia breaking their contract with me that we signed 4 or 5 years ago, and there are 4 or 5 more years remaining on it. Again, not an attorney, but just reading it in simple language, that's concerning to me and concerning to a lot of people that you can't transfer ground. The first oyster ground I ever got was in 1980, and I had to buy the lease. It's been my experience, you can take up all the bottom that's out there that you want to, but you cannot make bottom without a tremendous expense. At best, $10,000 to the acre, at cheapest, I should say. If you're going to do that on marginal bottom, it can't be done. I mean, it just can't be done. As AJ said, the shell's on here. The seed availability, there is good seed in James River, but getting it to your ground is not easy. The commission passed a regulation that Mr. Button and Ben and Commissioner Bowman are both looking at, but with the user fee, and the user fee was passed to limit the dredge fishery. Well, it went into all of the oyster fisheries, so if you didn't have a user fee by a certain date, then now you cannot get one. So at 66 years old, I've got to go up James River and tong my own seed, but I've got four 30-some-year-old boys that work for me that cannot because they didn't pay a user fee 10 years ago. So you're asking me to seed my ground, but you're not giving me any help with a tremendous public resource sitting up there to be able to do that. It makes it difficult, and that user fee was an unintended consequence, and I hear the possibility of many unintended consequences here. I know a lot of work's gone into this, and from staff, from the committee, and I'm not knocking it. I mean, I don't mean to dismiss that and the effort being genuine. As I said, I've known Ben for a long time, and I think if we sat down and had a discussion about a piece of oyster ground and I didn't get it, I'd be satisfied with why I didn't get it. If I got it, I think he would be satisfied with why I got it. Who's going to sit in his chair? I don't know. There are plenty of people that are looking, enjoy power over other people. They could be sitting in that same seat and delegating the authority. We all know what paves the gates to hell, and that's good intentions. And I know there's good intentions here, but I hope all of us have been in the real world long enough to know that the unintended consequences from trying to legislate or regulate what we think is best is not at all a good thing. AJ touched on it briefly, but this language of the public interest, I mean, that's painting stuff with a broad brush. You can use that for anything. And as AJ said, the public interest was looked out for when Mr. Baylor surveyed. That is the ground that is open to anyone. Well, it's not anymore because of the user fee thing, but that's the ground that was given to the public. This was marginal and set aside, and people had, the first ground I bought was in 1982 or 3, and it was 500 acres of multiple pieces. I paid $50,000 for it, which was one whopping sum of money in 1980. 3 years later, everybody knows what happened. We had MSX and Dermo. I had made just about enough money to pay for the ground in those 3 years, and 20-some years down the road, almost 30, did not sell another oyster until about 2004 or 2005. I know there's language in there for catastrophic events, but all during those events, don't know what code section it is, I'm sure Ben does, that says that an emergency can be declared where you don't have to pay ground rent. Mr. Pruitt took that to VIMS, the director of VIMS, and he decided it was not a good idea because we'd send the, quote, wrong message to the public that VIMS and VMRC were not adequately managing the resource. So we got no ground relief, rent relief, paid rent on that ground for all those years keeping it. Had I not done it in 2005 when we started to see a resurgence in the oyster population, I wouldn't be doing that. My sons wouldn't be doing that. And again, there's a lot of history there and a lot of time spent, and I understand the General Assembly told y'all to do something, but I certainly hope you will take into consideration a lot of things, like her comment on the sum meeting the whole, and moving forward, we'll do something as benign as you can. Virginia has been a model for the oyster business forever. The private-public balance that we have and have maintained has been extremely productive. Other states have tried to copy it and can't. And it's like we're reinventing the wheel here with something that really doesn't need to be done. If I can't make that bottom productive, who's going to take it up and make it productive? If I'm giving the Commonwealth their due rent, then what difference does it make to the Commonwealth? So that's, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to y'all. Appreciate the hard work that you've put into this, and good luck.
Thank you for your comment.
Quick question. Yes, not for you, Robbie, for Ben. When a lease is renewed, is that considered a new contract, or is it a continuation of the contract that was originally entered into when the lease was first let?
So the way the code's written, it's pretty clearly states that a 10-year renewal is just a renewal. It's not a new lease.
So it's a continuation.
Of the original. A transfer. That's a new lease, a right. New contract with a new person.
Right, I understand that.
Jay.
That question came up early, that the gentleman raised on what happens in the situation where the transfer during the governor's work group. And I know we had a sidebar with the Attorney General's office on that question, and they said, you have a right to a transfer that's written into your initial contract, but the terms of that transfer, because it's initiating a new contract, are not static.
Right.
And that was the determined. That was their opinion. As now, we could run it up the chain for an official OAG opinion, but that was the attorney's initial response. Just so you had background.
If I may speak one more time, I appreciate that response, but an unofficial opinion is not much of an opinion. I've sat on several boards that sought opinions from the Attorney General's office, and when it was not official, it was considered to be one another lawyer's opinion and no more.
Great. Thoughts, comments, or questions before we talk about next steps? So we have some options in front of us. We are going to request a public hearing. We will circle back with you all on language from Mark on the disaster mortality events, and we will circulate that. There will be a fairly tight turnaround on that to get responses. We're going to probably give you about 72 hours and assume silence is assent, because we have to take this to public comment or to request a public hearing. We can still make changes. So sort of before we request a public hearing in March, which will be in a couple of weeks, and then we have the public hearing in April. The committee can decide if we want to meet between now and then. We are not likely to make any substantive changes to the document other than the language we have talked about today, the language from Mark and the language that Bev brought up clarifying two and three. Kim, you have a question?
Will you all consider AJ's language for a new bullet?
We can look into that. It has been, from feedback that we've gotten and from looking back at the governor's work group, there has been I don't want to say a reticence, but there's a reason leases are individual, and that we have tried to provide language in here that will capture the ability to link leases while addressing some of the comments that Becky has laid out. So we will look at that if that is included. That can also be addressed at public comment before the commission.
As a clarifying point, so since Kim brought it up, Robbie's question, I don't know if it was a question or a comment, but said a little bit different than what I think I put down in consideration for that factor, which was just multiple leases for a leaseholder.
Okay.
But what if the production standard for one or more pieces of ground under that same leaseholder's name is highly productive? Is it the cumulative amount of that productivity divided by the number of acres that had, or is it individual leases? Now, what I just heard Ellen say was that it's on a lease-by-lease basis, because this is obviously a lease renewal.
It's on a lease-by-lease basis.
Right. But that point that he brought up does make a whole lot of sense, in my opinion.
I think it also gets some of the questions, though, and the comments that Becky and Russ have raised as well, which is this is not just so back to the governor's working group, which started all of this. You know, there was a variety of stakeholders at the table, and we talk about this largely in terms of what is sort of favorable to the industry, how to help all of that. There are other stakeholders at the table that we have to consider, and I think there is a, I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth, but I think in terms of connecting the leases, I think there was a lot of consternation and heartburn about that from the get-go. So if the question, I think it's still the intent of the staff, and we can talk about this as, you know, as a subject of that we are going to evaluate leases to the extent we can on a lease-by-lease basis, unless as clarified in here, which goes into operational plans and things like that, and adjacent ground. So we're trying to find that middle ground. But in terms of a productivity standard across all leases, that has not been talked about, the exact language, that has not been talked about to date here, and I feel like would be a pretty substantive shift from what we have considered. And so I think we can talk about it. We are probably going to move this document forward as is for the public hearing and for the commission's consideration with the additional comments that we heard today. Because at some point we gotta move forward. Mike, and then Mark.
Are you gonna consider delayed implementation?
Yes, that is something I want to talk to the secretary's office about and the commissioner about, not the commissioner, because he's going to hear this. I don't know if we'll take it to him other than public comment, but we will need to think about what that looks like. But I think that actually is a pretty good idea, because I think that's what's going to happen in effect anyway. So, yes. Mark.
I just wanted to get a clear picture on whether or not Russ had offered a language change for line 149.
Yep.
Sure. I don't really care. I think line 149 could stay, but at the very least, the addition of the change that Russ had, and because he said in that shellfish production, I didn't bring up one of my other comments elsewhere because that would have taken care of it.
Okay.
Which is, at the present time, this all talks about clam or oyster production. Do you want to rewrite this when somebody comes to you with bay scallop production?
Or blood arc,
something different. So If we don't need to go back and rewrite all of that, if some of the generic language that Russ offered about under these sets of additional factors, it's other shellfish, that it's shellfish production. As long as it says that one place, I don't think you need to go back and cross out clams and oysters. And like you've got a place where you're talking about how many oysters and how many clams, and we couldn't begin to talk about how many blood arcs or how many scallops. But as long as shellfish production is in this list of additional factors generically, you're left with a, sort of a clearer path without reverting to things that aren't listed to credit new products when they come along, which may or may not take hold, but people are definitely going to try.
Okay. Yeah. I think that we, thanks for reminding that, I think what it'll say is sort of other permitted shellfish water column. We can work on that.
Yep.
Too late. This is how you get elements.
It's not going to say floats, right? Because that the essence of my comment was it would just say other shellfish production activity
permitted though.
Within the lease area.
Permitted is the key part of that.
Okay.
The permit will stay. We can go to other shellfish activity.
If
we can just strike floats. Okay.
Be careful about saying water column, because blood arcs or bay scallops probably aren't going to be water columns.
So this is where I feel like we're getting into sort of weird territory, because this specific bullet, as Ben mentioned, is intended to cover activities on a lease that you need a permit for, which really is flips. So Mark, to answer your concerns, we can try to find a place to shellfish in.
Other shellfish production. It's just broadly could be a concern.
But this is specifically for permitted activity.
Well, then don't do it on the
other. Oh, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying we can try to find some other place to put.
This is really just additional factors to be considered, and I just might as well list it generically, because somebody's going to turn in to you at some point, not too distant future,
I was growing the following on it. I haven't figured out how to sell them yet, but I was growing.
First of all, I was proposing to get back to the previous question about float, to just eliminate float or other permitted water column and just call it shellfish production activity.
Permit.
Right. That requires a permit. I get a little heartburn with Mark's because this code section is about oyster lease ground only, which is clams as well. It's not about scallops. It's not about... We may permit that, but I'm not sure it fits in this until we have a scallop lease program or something equivalent. So I understand what you're saying and making it simpler to move forward. I just fear that we put it in here and then we're hamstrung because we got it in here and General Assembly passes home a whole new structure for scalloping that doesn't fit this. And we got to go back.
Aren't clams covered by a little statement in the code that says everything
yes.
in advance?
Clams are, but
yeah.
no other
yes.
type of
so
shellfish.
So we just put bay scallops in that section. We put blood arcs in that section.
So, question for you all. Do you want to meet between now and the next commission meeting, which I think will be the afternoon of April 13th, would be the second Monday of April, to go over this? There's not going to be any, we are not going to make any additional changes other than what we talked about. We will send this document back out to you with the changes highlighted in red that will only reflect what we talked about today. So there's no surprises on either end. And then the public comment will be in April. Mike.
Depends on whether you want to start on a new topic. We have lots of other topics, operational plan.
So that's my second question is there are, we also need to get into lease permits and use plans. I think a number of you reached out about talking about SAV after the last.
Yes.
Yes. So what we could do is we could perhaps take a bit of a break on talking about like the use plans and the beneficial stuff and talk about SAV next time on the 13th. Jay, were you stretching your hand?
That time it was a hand,
okay.
But it's just to support what you...
Oh, okay. So that way, and if for any reason we had to make any dramatic changes, we're not going to. So, but we can also, at that meeting, just get the final sort of, if you guys can take a formal vote, then we can take it to the commission. A formal vote to indicate whether or not you support this at that meeting. We can talk about SAV at that meeting.
Where we are on our comments, I'm looking down there, Fran, where we are in our comments for SAV, April might be a little premature.
Okay.
I was going to suggest that you ask Roger Mann, Jim Wesson et al. To brief the committee on their project.
We can see if they're available that day on the 13th. We can ask them to do that. They may not be available.
They have some significant information that you all are going to hear
okay.
in a couple of weeks, I think. You have a meeting with them.
Is that? Yes. So, hold on, I'm going to finish this note.
I think we should meet on the 13th.
Okay.
You said the hearing's on the 14th. Is that what you're saying?
The public hearing will be at the commission meeting, which is April 28th.
Okay. April 28th, so I think we should meet. Because
okay.
there are changes, but I'd like to have at least the final comment.
Okay.
The guidelines.
Okay.
And it feels like we do have a lot of stuff to do.
Okay. April 13th should be a Monday. So we can do that. It is the Monday after Easter weekend. I'm going to flag that for people. Okay. 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 Well, you guys can always send your comments in email, and we can read those into the record. We're always happy to, like, that's why we have the extended comment period for this open, to get comments and do all that. So
for this one, I could do that, but if I'm going to miss out on the information on the SAV, then I'd rather do that at another time when more people will be here.
Okay.
For the
will of the committee, I mean, I think SAV is a pretty important issue, so if we want to have as many people as we can, we could do a short meeting on the 13th, just sort of for the last committee hurrah on the guidelines document, and do SAV in May. Does that?
That's the second Monday.
I feel like I'm somewhere. But okay, so we can send out dates. We'll do that. We can send out dates from. So what I'm hearing is we're going to meet in April. It will likely be a short meeting because hopefully the only thing we're going to deal with in April is the last hurrah on the guidelines document, which will just be the final talk through of what we did, any last comments, recognizing there will be minimal, no changes. And then the public hearing the following week and a half. Yeah, public hearing will be a week and a half later. And then in May, we can set a date to do SAV, the SAV conversation, and we will pick up beneficial use in the summer. I just recognize in the summer that schedules get a lot harder. People are working and vacations and schools and things, schools out and stuff like that. So we can pick up beneficial use. Any other thoughts, comments, questions, concerns? All right. Well, we thank you all for your participation as always. And as always, you can always reach out to any of us if you have additional questions. We will circulate the language on this hopefully by the end of the week. And we'll put out a note. Thank you all.